Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental.
Dan Wallach, Dan Lust. One of these special episodes where we only have one topic on the docket. We are going to be talking in depth about the story of Sam Bankman-Fried. That is the FTX saga, which is now bringing in a lot of big named athletes. Tom Brady certainly heads up that bunch, but no shortage of star power between David, Trevor Lawrence, a lot of people from the sports and entertainment realm.
Joining us today will be Alan Milstein, who's a longstanding member of the sports law community, and he's represented professional athletes throughout his entire career. He brought the landmark Maurice Claret lawsuit against the National Football League to invalidate the NFL draft. He won that at the lower court level. It got overturned in the Second Circuit, but he's represented a coterie of professional athletes throughout his legendary, you know, sports law career. And I couldn't think of a better guest to weigh in on the legal vulnerability and the legal issues surrounding the world of athlete endorsements, because that's what this FTX case is about. This isn't the implosion of FTX is impacting the whole crypto world and going to lead to congressional hearings. And it's so far reaching, but it's also impacting the professional sports world and could really shake the foundation of how athletes and celebrities approach endorsement deals in the future. And this is like a who's who of defendants. We got Tom Brady and Giselle, Steph Curry. The Golden State Warriors have been sued. Shaquille O'Neal, David Ortiz, Trevor Lawrence, Shohei Ohtani, Naomi Osaka, Larry David, and Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary and Udonis Haslam. And this is one of the most important sports law lawsuits that I could imagine because of how it impacts the world of endorsements, which is really a subject that we continue to harp on throughout all these NIL episodes.
I think that's the perfect touch point. And Dan, as you know, in my practice, we represent athletes and entertainers. And let's just say that we had an all hands on deck meeting when the news of this story came out. And the question really was like, we have to maybe, right? We can't just, if someone throws a lot of money, right? You have to really vet that company for this particular purpose. It could be a fire festival, right? Or it could be FTX. But right, without the proper due diligence, you could be walking into really a hornet's nest. So let's start here. So for those that don't know, for those that haven't been living under a rock, everyone is all of a sudden, you know, really diving into this this crypto space. But a little bit of background on our villain. I think at one point he was the hero of the story of sports crypto. Now he's kind of the villain. Guy by the name of Samuel Bankman-Fried, born March 6, 1992. People call him SBF. So he's the founder and former CEO of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX. Now, Dan, I imagine you and Alan are going to get into, there's a little bit of a weird relationship between the cryptocurrency exchange FTX and the hedge fund Alameda Research, a little bit of Bernie Madoff-esque allegations, taking client funds and using them in a little bit of a Ponzi scheme, but we'll get into that at some point. With respect to Sam Bankman's background, he's the son of two Stanford law professors. So there's our law tie-in for our folk that are keeping tabs on us. But yeah, he works in the finance space. He ends up moving over to crypto, I think, in 2019. And yeah, right, he starts an exchange. It's not the biggest exchange in the world. I think Binance is, you know, technically the number one leader in the field. But for all intents and purposes, Sam Bankman-Fried was like the mascot of cryptocurrency. People see that big wavy hair. It kind of looks like Albert Einstein mixed with Sideshow Bob. He kind of looks like the prototypical image of the crypto space. So yeah, there's been some really big VC money that's been pouring into his company, Sequoia Capital. It's a company which, Dana, I imagine you guys touch upon at some point. Everybody, I think, tried to do their or claimed to do their due diligence on FTX. And it's a failure of epic proportions how a $10 billion company, I think it was $18 billion at some point, just kind of poof, goes up in the air, which tells you that people weren't looking at it this closely. So yes, you could throw a lot of money at Naomi Osaka and Steph Curry and Tom Brady. But now, right, you're on the other side of it with potential money being clawed back by the looming bankruptcy here. So Dan, I'll give it to you. Obviously, Alan's a fantastic guest. I've been watching your Twitter feed. You're certainly in the weeds of this like you always are. You know, where do you want to take this? Where does your conversation with Alan kind of go?
We focused on the law surrounding celebrity endorsements, athlete endorsements. That's going to be governed by, you know, Federal Trade Commission guidelines and case law. I think we're really looking at a likely to mislead standard. But put that aside for a moment, because in thinking about this lawsuit, two of the aspects that are overlooked are two of the most chilling phrases in the English language if you're a defendant's attorney. The words are strict liability and joint and several liability. This platform has had $30 billion in value evaporate almost overnight.
Wow.
Billions of dollars of customer losses, a house of cards, a Ponzi scheme. The debtor is bankrupt. Sam Bankman-Fried saw all of his net worth basically, you know, evaporate down to zero. So who are the deep pockets left standing? In a world where there's, you know, billions of dollars traded on this cryptocurrency exchange, the professional athletes and the entertainers are miraculously the ones left standing as the deep pockets. And that's who the class action plaintiff's lawyers are bringing a lawsuit against, based upon aiding the sale of unregistered securities, as well as engaging in deceptive and unfair trade practices through making these sort of misleading, false and misleading advertisements to prop up the company. So what struck me was the plaintiff's theory of the lawsuit. And I'm going to read, I've never seen a complaint, the class action complaint, open with a line like this. There can be no dispute that the claims in this case must provide for strict liability. And therefore, if these YBAs are found to be securities, and I'll explain what the YBAs are in a second, if they're found to be securities, then all of the FTX brand ambassadors, meaning all of the athlete and celebrity endorsers, have no defense to the claims in this action. And they're liable for all of the class members' losses, all billions of dollars of it, jointly and severally, and to the same extent as if they were themselves the FTX entities. That's a pretty big number to write on a check. Tom Brady may have to play 100 more seasons.
Brady, of all people, too, Dan, has been in some pictures with SBF. You know, there's probably a level that, you know, for their image, right, separate and aside from the actual financial ramifications and exposure, the fact that they've tied their brands to such a terrible company. Dan, we're still talking about Kendall Jenner's orange tile that she posted for Fire Festival. And that was like, you know, we're getting close to 10 years on that.
Here's why the defendants in this case, the athletes and their attorneys. And when you look ahead in the NIL deals, the issue could be here, joint and several liability, as well as strict liability. The plaintiffs are proceeding down two alternative and two separate legal pathways. They're claiming that these accounts that customers open up with FTX, that are basically yield-bearing accounts, they're known as YBAs, that those are in the nature of securities. And for those of us who follow the world of cryptocurrency, it's such a confusing area. So many of us have a little bit of knowledge, but we really can't quite, you know, sort of, you know, explain it and truly understand the full realm of this industry. So it's so amorphous to think about what it is that the customers are buying and what's the nature of the investment. So we're going to roll a clip of the plaintiff's attorney describing what it is that investors are purchasing. It's not just cryptocurrency. They're basically giving money to FTX to hold and then to stake and risk and invest, to pull together all the customer funds based on the promise of a yield of like 8%, some variable yield. So instead of thinking about it as you're buying crypto, no, you're not buying crypto. You're putting your crypto or money on deposit with FTX. They're pooling your money with other customer money to the tunes of billions of dollars, and they're staking and investing it to try to get a rate of return to pay off the yield that they've promised these customers. So there are millions of customers that have pooled their funds to the tune of billions of dollars. So it's not a coin, it's not Bitcoin, it's not you're buying cryptocurrency as the crypto a security. It's simply in the nature of indebtedness, a loan, a note. And I'm gonna have Anna Moskowitz, the plaintiff's attorney, or one of the three plaintiff's attorney, along with Stephen Zack and the famous David Boies, I'm going to have Mr. Moskowitz explain in plain English what it was the customers were buying.
If you keep your money with FTX, you're getting 8% interest or so each month. You're not trading in crypto. They're just holding your money. That's what was lost. The $15 billion that was stolen from these investors, it's not a risky trade. Everybody keeps thinking, well, these people were trading crypto. They weren't. They were keeping the money in this interest account at FTX that was stolen.
So in essence, I mean, the class members are basically being offered interest-bearing accounts, and then the money disappears. They not only do they get no return on their investment, but their investment disappears overnight. Billions of dollars of losses. So the complaint basically proceeds down two different pathways. Number one, there's the security issue, and that the complaint alleges that these YBA accounts are in the nature of a security. Why is that important? Because if it's a security, then the securities are unregistered. And the sale of unregistered securities is a tort cause of action under Florida statutes for strict liability for either selling or, in the case of the celebrities, materially assisting the sale of unregistered securities, gives the plaintiffs in this case a right of rescission to basically get back their entire investment. And the defendants are jointly and severally liable to make good on that, basically billions of dollars under a theory that this is the sale of unregistered securities. So we're going to discuss with Alan whether or not this is a security. And then later on, I'll kind of address the merits of that issue in greater detail. Number two is that this is a deceptive and unfair trade practice governed by Florida's unfair and deceptive trade practice law, which requires a likelihood of deception to the reasonable consumer. It's not based upon an individualized assessment, but whether a reasonable consumer would likely have been misled by these advertisements. The damages recoverable under that are actual damages between based what you were promised versus what the value of what you have now is. And if your investment has been completely wiped out, your damages are your entire investment. So that's where the complaint draws upon in alleging joint and several liability under either a securities framework or under a deceptive and unfair practices framework. And then there's the issue of strict liability. You don't need scienta or malintent under each theory. So let's take this into a deeper dive as to what the obligations of the athletes are in making their endorsements and touting products under FTC law and under the securities laws.
Okay. A reminder, our podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. Use our promo code CONDUCT for a special promo code. Again, if you're having any difficulties, you have any questions about Themis Bar, certainly reach out to us. We are happy to help. Without further ado, Dan, let us kick it over to your discussion with Alan Milstein.
It is my pleasure to welcome back to Conduct Detrimental the one and the only Alan Milstein, the chairman of the litigation department of Sherman Silverstein. And Alan is the perfect guest to weigh in on this FTX scandal in the sports world, because throughout his career, Alan has represented numerous professional athletes and entertainers and can really speak to the vulnerability or potential liability of the athletes in these various civil class action lawsuits. So Alan, welcome back again to Conduct Detrimental. How are you?
I'm good. Pleasure to be here.
This is something else. In the span of just a couple of weeks, FTX has imploded, bankruptcy proceedings, billions of dollars missing, assets moved, shifted around, bankrupt company. There's no money to be found. Yet the professional athletes and entertainers may be the ones holding the bag, basically, at the end of the day. They're the ones who the class action lawyers are targeting in these new lawsuits. So let's back up a second and drill down into what this case is about. There are two separate class action lawsuits filed in the Southern District of Florida. One is brought by Garrison, and the other one, I think, is Cavouri. They're basically related cases brought by different account holders of FTX. Now, I'm not an expert on cryptocurrency, and whenever many people see the words crypto, it's like, what is this all about? What's the big mystery around crypto? Is this a cryptocurrency case?
I think it's simpler than that. You don't really have to know anything about crypto. FTX was what's called a crypto exchange. What kind of exchanges do we all know about? We have the New York Stock Exchange. We have the NASDAQ Exchange. And that's what FTX was analogous to. But instead of buying stocks, you would go to the crypto exchange, to FTX, to buy crypto. You don't buy the crypto from FTX, but that's where the marketplace is. And then the sister company, this Alameda, is a very, I think it's analogous to a hedge fund. It was an entity that bought high-risk investments in crypto. Now, what the public allegedly did not know was that there was this relationship between FTX and Alameda, whereby Alameda essentially was using FTX funds to invest in these very risky investments and bought the cryptocurrency on margin. But again, using FTX's money. And that's what allegedly was not disclosed to the public. And when the margin call came in on Alameda, the money had to come not from Alameda, but from FTX, which had essentially guaranteed the funds. And as soon as the investing public found out about that, that is that FTX was now going to have to essentially disgorge millions and millions and millions of dollars to cover Alameda's margin calls, there was an old-fashioned run on the bank. Now, the problem was that FTX allowed individuals to essentially park their money at FTX and guaranteed that they would get in the range of 8% interest, could always get their money back, had no risk whatsoever.
So this wasn't just, you know, a platform or an exchange in which cryptocurrency was traded. The nature, can you describe the nature of the investment that one of these consumers makes? Is like you're opening up an FTX account. Automatically, are you part of this yield-bearing account program, or is that a special program? Just put into, I guess, plain English so that I can understand it and our audience can understand it. What was the nature of the investment that each, I guess, plaintiff class member made here?
Think of it as your Schwab account. You put $1 million in your Schwab account so that you can buy stocks and through Schwab. You're reasonably assured that if you don't want to buy stocks or if you need $100,000 of your $1 million, you can either write a check on your Schwab account or just ask for the money back. But the difference here was when you invested, when you put the money into the FTX accounts, they would give you a note. And that's what these YAB securities essentially were, these notes that essentially said, Dan Wallach has, I wouldn't use the word invested, but Dan Wallach has parked $1 million into the FTX account. We're going to give him 8% interest on his money. And anytime he wants to get it out, all he's got to do is ask.
That's a note. That's a loan. That's indebtedness. Are we talking about a security here? And that's a legal term of art that has consequences under the law, because if it's a security, now we're talking about the sale of unregistered securities. And I think that's where the athlete's vulnerability comes into play, because they're assisting in the marketing of unregistered securities. So I guess the $64,000 or $64 billion question is what these account holders have, is what they're being marketed and sold, is it a security for purposes of the SEC versus Howey test and under the broader definition governed by Florida law?
Well, I don't think you should think of it as a security the way a share of stock is a security. Think of it more as an IOU. You've essentially parked your money there. When you put your money in the bank, you don't get in return for every dollar you put in, you don't get a little note that says, we, the bank, promise to give you your money back. You don't, that doesn't happen. In this case, that's what it was. But you weren't investing in FTX such that if FTX, you know, made a lot of money somehow in this or that, you would get a lot more money. No, you essentially were parking your money there in return for a promise that you'd get at 8% or so interest on your money and could take it out whenever you wanted. And the key, I think, to me is no risk. So you're not buying a security that could go up and down depending on the market. You're essentially just putting your money there for interest with no risk. But of course, and this is, the key in as it comes to, as it relates to everyone involved in this case, if you are getting 8% on your money, guaranteed, no risk, you should say to yourself, too good to be true. It's exactly what happened in the Madoff situation.
This is worse than Madoff in some respects. I guess Madoff had secured the trust and had kind of a fiduciary relationship with his clientele. There was no personal relationship between Sam Bankman-Fried, FTX, and the millions of people who opened up these accounts. But the losses, right. the losses here are in the billions.
In the billions. But the genius here and the genius in Madoff was not a scheme where you're going to, it's not like, Dan, give me $100,000 and in 3 weeks, I'll give you $200,000. You're going to double your money. That's the classic Ponzi scheme. The brilliance of Madoff and the brilliance in this scheme is, in Madoff, it was 15%. You're going to make 15% on my trades. Not 100%, not 50%, 15%. And here you're only going to make 8%. Not 100%, not 50%, 8%. So you don't have to think of yourself as a pig. You're just going to make a reasonable return on your money. But in an age where you're only getting 2% on a CD, on a five-year CD, or a half a percent at your bank, if you're getting 8% guaranteed and they're telling you no risk, you know or should know. That's the legal terms here. You know or should know. It's too good to be true.
Yeah, but we're dealing with unsophisticated people. Not everyone is a institutional investor. This is sort of retail accounts. These are people who may not even know anything about crypto and don't understand the risk that they're taking. So is it incumbent upon the investor to do his due diligence and to know better? Or is the burden of disclosure on the issuer, the salespeople, and the agents to be truthful? Well,
I think it's on both. I mean, and you don't have to be sophisticated to know that if you put $100,000 in Chase Bank, they're only going to pay you a half a percent interest, right? I mean, you're not getting more than that. You don't have to be a sophisticated investor to know that you're not getting a lot of interest at the bank. Now, if you're getting 8% guaranteed, no risk, I don't think you have to be that sophisticated to know or should know that it's too good to be true.
But is the absence of risk, or at least the perceived absence of risk, does that cut against the notion that this is a security? When I have money sitting in a five-year CD, I don't view that as a security the same way that I would if I had, you know, shares of Microsoft and Google. I mean, there's risk there. I expect a return on my investment, but I understand that I could lose. I could suffer losses. If the customer is expecting a guaranteed rate of return, does that preclude a finding that this is a quote-unquote security? And you mentioned before that security doesn't necessarily equate only to shares of stock in a company. They could be other types of instruments, notes, bonds, debentures, evidences of indebtedness. What makes this a security or an investment contract in if you believe that to be true? I think the Howey test sets forth, you know, four basic, you know, fundamental principles, that it's an investment of money with a reasonable expectation of profit dependent upon the efforts of others, and there's a common enterprise. This investment, or this, you know, sort of FTX YBA vehicle, seems to have all of the bellwethers of an investment of money, common enterprise, expectation of profits based on the efforts of others. But you're also describing a guaranteed rate of return. So
if you buy a 12-month treasury bond, there's no risk to it. It's a guaranteed interest. And what a treasury bond is, a security. So the fact that there's no risk doesn't make it not a security. But yeah, Remember, we're not talking about the federal the definition under the Securities Act of what a security is. We're talking about a very, very much broader definition of a security in the Florida Act, which simply is defined as, in one of the 30 different categories, a note. I think you should not be so concerned with whether it is an investment. I mean, when you put $100,000 in the bank, you don't think into yourself, that's an investment, right? I'm not investing in the bank. I'm depositing my money in the bank. And that's what the FTX situation really was. You were depositing money into FTX. The difference between FTX and a bank is, one, it's not federally insured. And two, they would give you this note.
Yeah.
And the note is what makes it a security, allegedly, under Florida law. I mean, I think the plaintiffs are going to have to prove that it meets the definition of a security under Florida law.
I think we're on the same page, Alan, because I'm admitted to practice in Florida. Of course, anybody could look up a statutory definition, and I just went back and looked. The word security is so broadly defined under Florida law, and as you pointed out, there are examples, illustrations, about 30 of them, including notes, which is what the FTX vehicle appears to be, bonds, evidence of indebtedness, and the investment contract scenario, which is the Howey test. And it seems to me, at least based upon the broader Florida statutory definition, that we're talking about a security here, that I don't think it's going to be a heavy lift to transform this, or at least to have a court determine this to be a security. And I've looked at all the cases. Every case involving crypto, even though this isn't just a coin or a crypto case, but in all the crypto fraud or crypto lawsuits I've seen, the issue of a security comes up time and again. And in each case, the determination made by the court was that it was a security, or that there was enough question or at least factual issues to get by a motion to dismiss. So the finding, or at least the determination that this is a security, would say, at least if I were representing athletes, or if I was an athlete myself, would send chills down my spine, because the repercussions under Florida law for selling or materially assisting the sale of an unregistered security is basically joint and several liability among all the defendants for a rescission of the purchase, meaning you get all your money back, and for losses in the neighborhood of billions of dollars. This should just send a message, or at least a warning, to the sports industry at large, to celebrities, to athletes, and for people like you and me who might advise them from time to time. So let's get to the threshold key question here. Do the athletes have vulnerability in this lawsuit, whether it's under a securities law framework or for deceptive and unfair trade practices based upon misleading consumers? You know, your typical FTC, you know, false and deceptive trade practices for which the cases involving celebrities are legion. Is there vulnerability here, Alan?
Here's what's interesting about this case from a sports law context. If you look at commercials that we all know, so let's say the Progressive insurance commercial with that one woman who's in every commercial, right? Or the AT&T cellular commercial with the same girl in all of it, or the Toyota commercial with the same woman who seems to be the spokesman, right? Mm-hmm. Those are just actresses in each of those cases. There's nothing about that person that's the reason she was chosen. The difference between them and when you use our sports heroes is that the reason that you have a Jack Nicklaus or a Phil Mickelson or a Steph Curry or a Tom Brady is because these people are essentially worshipped by their fans. The fans, when they see Tom Brady up hawking a particular product, instantaneously rely on what he's saying. He's not just this nameless actor. He's Tom Brady, and he's telling you something. And they are banking, and I'm using that phrase sort of as a pun, they are banking on your respect, idolization, love, and all-around fanatic devotion to the athlete. That's why he or she is in that commercial. They are essentially the product that's paying Tom Brady to be in the commercial, the company that's paying him to be in the commercial, is exploiting the fans' essentially love for that athlete as a means of selling their product. So that's why the athletes have to be a little bit more careful than the actress who plays Flo. Right. No one thinks there really is a flow. Right? You know, she's an actress, but you've got a real person here who's using your love for him to essentially convince you to buy a product.
So
if it's simply beer, or if it's simply golf clubs, then maybe the athlete doesn't have to make sure that the product that he or she is hawking does what it says it's going to do. But yeah, when it's an investment vehicle, then I think the athlete needs to make sure that this product is for real.
How can they do that if they're athletes that may not lack, that may not possess financial sophistication? LeBron James, you know, he's not an MBA in finance. What obligations would a Steph Curry or Tom Brady or Gisele Bündchen have in terms of due diligence? Do they have to substantiate or make sure the company has appropriate compliance safeguards? What is the athlete's obligation in being a pitch person, pitch man or pitch woman for a company?
I think the athlete needs to understand the product that he or she is selling. And it's one thing to sell beer. And it's one thing to sell scotch. And it's one thing to sell golf clubs or sneakers. But if it's a product that the athlete knows nothing about, why don't you be like Larry and say, no, I think I'm going to pass on this one.
He turned out to be right
for sure.
But the message in his advertisement was just the opposite, because he was wrong about everything else. And they used Larry David as the straw man to sort of prove the converse of his message, that this is just another example of Larry being wrong again. And by participating in this advertisement, the real Larry David, rather than the Curb Your Enthusiasm Larry David, was giving an implied endorsement or an express endorsement of the company through his well-known character.
My personal view, and this is somebody who's a big Larry David fan, as you know, my personal view is that Larry shouldn't be a defendant here, because in Larry's ad, he is clearly an actor saying lines. There's no doubt about it. I mean, he's not sitting there with Tom Edison. He's not sitting there with Christopher Columbus. And he's not sitting there with somebody hawking crypto or FTX. He's an actor. So he's not saying, look, I'm Larry David. I've invested in this company, or I've partnered with this company, or I'm an ambassador to this company. You should really buy it. And I'm just sort of satirizing my own self. I don't think you can read that in his ad. Because I think most of us who watch Larry know he really is Larry. He really is someone whose motto is curb your enthusiasm. And that's what all of the athletes should have been doing with respect to the approach that must have been made to them to be a spokesman for this company. They should have all curbed their enthusiasm and said, you know what? I think I'll stick to beer or sneakers or the kinds of products that I understand, instead of trying to get my fans, because again, they're exploiting their fans. I think the athletes should have said to themselves, you know what? I'm not so sure I want my fans to go out and use their hard-earned cash for this product, because they may lose money. And if they lose money, they may not love me so much.
What's the threshold for liability? I mean, in some of these ads, you know, David Ortiz basically just asks, are you in? Tom Brady, Gisele Bündchen, FTX, are you in? You know, some of these are so benign, and some are worse than others. But for example, Kevin O'Leary said that FTX met his own rigorous standards for compliance, which is a completely bizarre statement in light of the fact that FTX has no compliance or internal compliance protocols. So what's the threshold for liability for an athlete or social media influencer or entertainer making a statement, or at least creating a perception? Is it false and misleading? Is it likely to mislead? Where's the line so that we can assess on a defendant by defendant basis whether they're potentially liable or it's just a long shot?
Well, the Steph Curry ad, he actually says, this is where I can feel safe about this investment.
Yeah, he says, I'm not an expert. Not an expert. But I have everything I need to know to buy, sell, and trade crypto safely. Would that statement have a tendency to mislead?
I don't think any of the advertisements by themselves are enough to impose liability on any of the athletes.
Why not?
I think the key question is going to be if it was the advertisement, if there's something in addition to the advertisement, if there's some kind of long-term agreement or even short-term agreement that says they will appear as a spokesman, they will be named as an ambassador to the company, that there's some kind of relationship. The worst word to use in this context is to say I'm a partner with FTX. Remember, there's also a civil conspiracy clause here. So in order for the plaintiffs to prove a civil conspiracy, there's got to be an agreement among the conspirators. And I think a key fact here is going to be, is there an agreement, some kind of written agreement, other than simply you're going to be in a 60-second commercial and you're going to make X dollars?
Well, I think we're talking about something beyond just a one-shot deal. I mean, to be called an official brand ambassador, I think implies that there's a brand ambassador type of contract with obligations to be sort of the spokesperson or to represent the brand in a positive way. It's got to go beyond just, you know, a one-off. Otherwise, what are we doing here? I mean, a commercial that 20,000 people may have viewed a year ago is all of a sudden going to be transformed into joint and strict liability to make David Ortiz liable for billions of dollars of customer losses that may have never even seen his commercial.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, but I don't like that phrase, brand ambassador. I have no idea what it means.
I went to the source, Alan. I went to Wikipedia. Believe it or not, there wasn't any cases. I didn't find one judicial decision that tried to tried to sort of put a description around it. The best I could come up with was Wikipedia, which is certainly nothing that anybody can rely upon. But I think brand ambassador connotes something official, more than just a simple advertisement, a connection to the brand that's ephemeral and not just limited to a particular ad read. And if it goes beyond that.
Was Michael Jordan a brand ambassador for Nike? I mean, I think he was. But I don't think he has liability if the Nike products aren't good.
He was synonymous with the brand, though. But I think the term brand ambassador has taken on different meaning in the decades since Michael Jordan first signed his shoe deal. It's now an official term of art. I mean, we still don't know what it means.
I don't think it's a term of art at all. I don't think it's a term of art at all. And I don't think using that phrase imposes liability. I think the determining factor is going to be whatever agreement, written agreement there is between the athlete and FTX, and what the obligations are of the athlete and what his essentially remuneration is.
What facts in an agreement would be problematic for the athlete if such a contract existed? And what facts as an attorney, especially as a plaintiff class action attorney, what facts would you be looking for to sort of tie the athlete to the material misrepresentations and omissions?
I think the key fact is what the obligations are of the athlete other than appearing in the commercial. If there's anything in there that says the athlete shouldn't give any interviews, mm-hmm. where he or she says the product is something I don't know anything about, or it's not a good product, you know, any kind of essentially linking that athlete to the representations made about the product, both in the athlete's commercial and in other commercials.
Going separate and apart from the substance of the statements in the commercials, could the athlete be liable if he doesn't even use FTX and the whole thing is just sort of a staged ad read and the athlete says, are you in? I'm in. And doesn't even use FTX. Or, for example, doesn't even take any steps to substantiate the truthfulness of anything. Does the athlete have, and I asked you earlier, but does the athlete have an obligation to sort of be, to have skin in the game and to find out the truth for himself before he or she agrees to do an advertisement as a celebrity, you know, testimonial?
I mean, I think it depends on what the ad is. I mean, did John Madden have to drink light beer for Miller and think it was less filling? I mean, did he have to do that? I mean,
he would have done it for free, I think. But,
you know, we see these athletes in all kinds of ads. Mm. And I don't think they have to use the product to be in the ad. But it depends on what they say. If in the ad they say, I've invested with these individuals, I've partnered with this entity, I've put my own money at risk, and you should feel safe putting your money at risk, then the athlete needs to essentially look at what he or she is representing in the ad. But if it's simply, you know, if it's just Larry David saying, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's enough.
Are there any examples from past cases that we can draw upon, you know, FTC lawsuits or any celebrities or athletes that have been involved in litigation in the past that we can use as a barometer for assessing, you know, what kinds of examples exist that can be instructive in analyzing these FTX class action lawsuits? Because under the Florida law that's being sued upon, the Florida Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Act, built into the statute is a statement that we're going to give deference, court should give deference to decisions and rulings of courts interpreting the FTC Act and even the interpretations given by the Federal Trade Commission. Are there any examples in years past involving pro athletes that could be looked to as precedent?
Well, I think the best case to look to is the Steve Garvey case, where he and his wife essentially talked about a product that allowed them to lose weight. And there was an action brought against Mr. Garvey. And the Ninth Circuit, which is a very liberal circuit, you would think it's a circuit that would bend over backwards to protect the consumer. The Ninth Circuit said, you can't hold Mr. Garvey and his wife liable unless they knew or should have known that they were misrepresenting a product and that those who watched the advertisement would rely on those misrepresentations. And I think that's the critical case. You know, I've read the other cases. I don't think the Yeager case really says much about that. But it's this know or should have known about the misrepresentation.
Are there any other cases, reported decisions that I think we could stop with the Garvey case, because that highlights, I think, the standard not only under federal law, but also under Florida's Deceptive and Unfair Trade Practices Act. The standard is the representation or omission, you know, likely to deceive a reasonable consumer? I mean, I've taken a look at this statute, and the beauty, or at least the disadvantage for these athletes, is that not only is there the possibility of joint and several liability, but the plaintiffs, at least on the security side, don't have to prove reliance on the sale of unregistered securities. But for FIDUPTA claims, proof of reliance is not an element. So you can get a class certified here, even without proving any individual consumer relied on any of the statements contained in the advertisements. But of course, they're still going to have to prove causation. And I think that's going to potentially be the death knell of any class action motion for class certification. But is likely to deceive the baseline here?
It's know or should have known, I think, on both sides. You know, you and I have talked about this, and maybe we disagree. But the Ponzi scheme cases, I think, are also important things to look at. In the Ponzi scheme cases, they do look at, even though it's supposed to be strict liability against the defendants, they do look at, in the clawback cases, the so-called injured parties. And the test for them is, again, did they know or should they have known that this scheme was too good to be true? Okay. And that's why I think there's some problem with the class certification issues.
In what sense? Which elements do you think pose the obstacles to getting a class certified here? We got millions of potential class members. So it's problematic from a manageability standpoint, but where do you think the real obstacles are in getting this to certify as a class action? Because we're not going to be trying thousands of individual cases. This has to go forward as a class action to have any staying power.
Well, there's a couple elements of class actions that make this problematic. So first, with respect to just the concept of a class action, the rules require numerosity. In other words, they require a number of class members to make a class action the vehicle to be used, but also require manageability. If there are too many members that make the class action unmanageable, then that would essentially defeat class certification. So that's one thing. Then the second is, again, there are no absolutes here. So the question is, are there common issues of fact and law with respect to all the members, knowing that there may be some questions of fact and law that are different among the members? But if there are more common questions of law and fact, then you might get class certification. Now here we've got one or two named class members, right? In both cases, the named class member has got to be representative of every other class member, every other one. Now, I know Mr. Boyce has said there may be millions of class members. I find it a little difficult to believe that the one or two named class members are representative of every single one of the proposed members of the class.
Why did he shoot his shot with just one class member? Although he did file a second lawsuit, so he does have two class members split among two parallel cases alleging almost identical facts. Was winning the race to get the first case filed an important consideration here?
I mean, I don't think you can deny that the plaintiff's attorneys wanted to be the first case filed. This is going to be litigation that's going to line the pockets of lawyers for years and years and years, both plaintiff lawyers and defense lawyers. You have defendants who have a lot of money and can afford to get very good lawyers.
Well, what's their exposure, Alan? I mean, Big Poppy does one World Series commercial a year and a half ago. How do you assess his liability? Is every celebrity misstatement essentially a guarantee for billions of dollars of all losses? Is there any sense of proportionality here in being able to assign Assuming that there's liability, how do you calculate damages on a defendant by defendant basis when they only appeared in one commercial, maybe, or only a small percentage of people actually were exposed to that commercial? Does that dynamic pose class certification problems? And moreover, how do you allocate responsibility while avoiding making these celebrities the guarantor of 100% of the losses that have been incurred here, which are in the billions?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I mean, if any of the people who have lost money in FTX didn't see any of the commercials, then how in the world can these defendants be liable to those individuals? They can't. I don't believe they can. And the only commercial I saw was the Larry David commercial. And, you know, I watch a lot of sports TV. I would think it was on sportscast that these commercials appeared. Have you seen any? Did you see any of the
others? Only the Larry David one. You and I are like Larry David fans. And that commercial is almost like a stand-in for a Curb Your Enthusiasm mini episode. It's the only one that really is, you know, standing the test of time that you're going to watch a year or 2 years later. The other ones are gone with the wind after the Super Bowl ends. So
were they all Super Bowl ads? I don't think they were.
No. Larry David's was.
Larry David's was
during the World Series. I mean, they all have different airings. And Kevin O'Leary, for example, used his social media accounts. You know, Naomi Osaka used her 1.1 million social media following to promote FTX. So we're not just talking about, you know, TV or radio commercials standing alone. But if you go from defendant to defendant, there are different levels of market penetration with how pervasive some of these statements are.
The Ohtani ad.
He says there's not even an ad. There's not even an ad for Ohtani. He's a brand ambassador. He received equity in the company. He got crypto and he served, quote unquote, as a spokesperson. There's no advertisement. It's even alleged in the complaint.
The other curious thing about, you know, they've chosen athletes with sterling reputations. I mean, Tom Brady, Steph Curry, Ohtani, Big Papi. I mean, athletes that you know, they're exploiting the idolatry that fans have for these athletes. Who's going to hold Big Papi liable? I mean, everybody loves Big Papi. Even Yankee fans love Big Papi.
I've come around on Big Papi because the fault lies not with Big Papi, but with the Yankees' brain trust for building one-dimensional teams throughout the early 2000s and the 2010s. So it's not Big Papi's fault that Brian Cashman is very limited in his talents as a general manager. So I don't think Yankee fans universally hate Big Papi. But
I mean, when Big Papi made that speech after the bombing, remember what Big Papi said? I don't know if I can say it on this podcast. He says, "This is our fucking city," right? I mean, that endeared him to all over the world. You know, who's going to hold Big Papi liable for right. saying
Put yourself in the shoes of a class action lawyer, which you have been. You're an experienced litigator, chairman of the litigation department of a firm and you've handled class action cases. What would you do? Put yourself on both sides of the V here. If you're representing these class action plaintiffs, if you're a co-counsel with David Boies, what are you doing to try to shore up this complaint, to try to have it succeed on a motion for class certification? Is it just simply finding more representative plaintiffs? What can you do to bolster this case?
Well, the first thing you do is you request of all of the defendants any agreements, communications, emails between you and FTX.
Merits because discovery or class certification discovery? Do you bifurcate discovery and make the ask in connection with the motion for class cert?
I don't think you have to, but if it turns out that any of these advertisements were, as you call, one-offs, and that the athlete had no real connection to FTX, I think you drop them as defendants. You know, it's not worth trying to sue somebody who essentially was an actor in an advertisement, because then all they are flow. You can't sue the actress in the Progressive ad because Progressive is a bad insurance. You know, if your allegations are Progressive is a bad insurance company, you can't sue Flo.
No, but they're touting a company, not a product. They're touting the entire company's integrity and worthiness and trustworthiness in a field that's relatively nascent where there's a lot of skepticism. They're vouching for the company and they're Big Papi. They're Larry David, notwithstanding the characterization in those commercials. They're Tom. They're Giselle. They're those real people who are idolized. Isn't that different than Flo touting?
I believe they're still touting a product. What they're saying is, If you go to this exchange, if you want to buy crypto, this is the safest place to be if you want to buy crypto. So I think they're still touting a product. They're not saying invest in FTX, you know, be a shareholder in FTX, because FTX was a, you couldn't buy shares on the open market of FTX. So what they were touting was the product that FTX sells, which is essentially being an exchange where you can buy crypto or parking your money in FTX to get that 8% interest.
Do you think there's anything else that can be done to amend the complaint to make it more, you know, I guess, class certification worthy? I mean, besides, you know, you're talking about dropping a few defendants, maybe adding more representative plaintiffs. Is there anything more that can be done?
Well, here's where the plaintiff's attorneys have the advantage over other attorneys in other kinds of cases. This debacle is something that is going to reverberate in markets all over the world. And Congress finally has woken up and decided that, one, they need to investigate this collapse, and they need to regulate the crypto industry. And so the plaintiff's attorneys in this case are going to get a lot of information out of the congressional inquiry, very free discovery. And I'm sure they hope that it's the kind of information that will bolden their case. And I'm sure with respect to some of the athletes, it will bolden their case. And with respect to other athletes, it will essentially require their dismissal as defendants.
You mentioned an article that Michael McCann, our friend Michael McCann, wrote for Sportico. You said that this case, you told me that this is the sports law case of the year. And in the Sportico piece, you said that this case is sure to rock the sports world like nothing that has happened before. How is this going to impact celebrity and athlete endorsements? Because is this going to just change how deals are negotiated? Will athletes take a different look and approach endorsement deals differently as a result of this lawsuit? Should they?
They absolutely should. And, you know, what's interesting about the lawsuit at this time in our sports law history is it comes at a time when amateur athletes finally can make NIL deals so that they can essentially earn money through endorsements. And I think what this lawsuit should tell all athletes is be careful what you endorse. You want to endorse beer or a shoe or a golf club? Fine. If it's a product you know nothing about and you understand that the advertisement that you're being asked to participate in asks your fans to invest their hard-earned money in it and perhaps risk it, then maybe wait for a different product to endorse. So I think it's going to change. It's going to make the athletes become aware that they need to at least look at the product that they're being asked to endorse and understand it. You know, one thing you said earlier, which I disagree with, which is, gee, these are athletes who don't know that much. You know, I think, you know, in some of, for, with respect to some of them, I think most fans understand that these athletes have consultants, have agents, have lawyers. And so it's, you know, I don't think anybody believes that, you know, these multimillionaire athletes essentially, you know, operate in a vacuum. I think most people believe they've got very good consultants and would assume that they might do some due diligence, or at least their consultants would do due diligence before allowing an athlete to essentially tout a particular product.
Is there any exposure here, Alan, for the consultants, attorneys, or advisors that may not have vetted or done their due diligence around FTX? What role does the advisor play in being the gatekeeper for, you know, fly, you know, just to ward off or, you know, distance these athletes from fraudulent operators, fly-by-night companies? And by the way, the athletes are not the only ones potentially at fault here. The Golden State Warriors, the Miami Heat, and Major League Baseball all have their own official deals with FTX. And that's a separate issue. It wasn't just the athletes that were maybe taken in by the, you know, sudden, you know, wave of FTX and the amount of money that was being spent. This goes throughout all the corners of the sports industry. But what should the advisors be doing, or the attorneys be doing, to guide their clients going forward. What would you be advising your client? And what kind of provisions would you want to see in a contract to safeguard the client from possible repercussions of being sued over a product?
Well, I don't think it's any exposure of the agents or lawyers to the plaintiffs in the class action.
To the clients.
There's certainly exposure to the clients. If one of these athletes had consulted with his or her attorney and said, is this a good deal? And can I do this? Am I safe? Look at the agreement that I'm entering into with FTX. Do you approve of the agreement? Should I sign it? And it turns out that that agreement ends up exposing them to liability, then yes, there's a problem with the agents or the lawyers who've made that kind of advice. With respect to the leagues, again, everything in this case cuts both ways. So to some extent, the fact that the Miami arena is the FTX arena cuts both ways, because no fan believes that Miami has done anything but just sell the name, you know, just sell the right to put their name on the arena. And so it cuts both ways, because as maybe no one should believe that the athletes in these advertisements are really, really, you know, insisting or representing anything with respect to FTX. That all it is an ad game. So I think the fact that Miami arena is called FTX arena, I don't think that bodes so well for the plaintiffs. Now, on the other hand, you know, the Golden State Warriors, at least allegedly, have said that FTX is the official crypto platform of the Golden State Warriors. That's not such a good fact for the Golden State Warriors.
I think what saved the Miami Heat, and I agree with you, what saved the Miami Heat is they don't own their building. This is a deal that was made by Miami-Dade County, between the county and FTX. So the Heat weren't a contracting party. I think the Heat are a beneficiary, but all the promotion is being done by the county, not by the Miami Heat, because the county owns and operates the building. And I think that's a key difference. Why Major League Baseball?
Everybody knows they just sold the right to the name. I mean, the Tostito Rose Bowl or whatever the Rose Bowl is now. Right. The Tostito Rose Bowl. I don't think anybody believes that all the players who are playing in the bowl game are eating Tostitos. No, they just sold the right to be called the Tostito Rose Bowl. That's all.
Final thought. We're now in the NIL era. And there are thousands of young attorneys and advisors who don't have any prior experience, many of whom don't have any prior experience in representing professional athletes. Is this opening up a new potential Pandora's box for attorneys representing athletes, amateur, collegiate athletes in NIL deals? Because we're talking about the same principles. I mean, luckily for these collegiate players, they're not named, none of them are named as defendants in this FTX lawsuit. But is this a potential dark cloud over NIL deals going forward if this is the potential exposure that can be faced if a business goes belly up?
Well, I think it is, but I think the dark cloud has a silver lining, which is essentially a very easy solution. Don't let your client become a spokesman for any product that you don't understand.
Or hire Alan Milstein to navigate those dark waters and hope, or those uncharted waters, because the experience level and sophistication of your attorney will go a long way towards, you know, steering you away from bad deals, and you know, having the maturity and experience of knowing which deals you stay away from with a 10-foot pole. So I think this has a lot of lessons for those who advise collegiate athletes in NIL deals as well. And we're gonna watch this litigation, because it's industry shaking. It could really, as you said, rock the sports industry to the core. And I think it just sends a warning shot to lawyers, advisors, and to athletes in doing their homework and due diligence and being very choosy as to what kinds of endorsement deals they want to take on. It's not always about the almighty dollar. The Miami Heat and Miami-Dade County just received $19.5 million in a naming rights deal. I wonder how much of that may get clawed back in a bankruptcy proceeding. And so many arenas, so many professional sports teams have basically sold their naming rights to the highest bidder. I mean, last night, Larry David is sitting front row, and you know, it's no joke here. I didn't set this up. The crypto.com arena, watching the Rangers, you know, beat the Los Angeles Kings 5-3. And I think the teams and the leagues are so focused on drawing blood from a stone and finding all these new revenue sources that there's this emphasis on securing the highest possible deal, irrespective of whether the brand is a reputable brand or not. Because how can you have said you've done due diligence on crypto.com or FTX when these are basically, you know, new companies and nobody really understands it? So I think this will change the sort of change the way, you know, teams, leagues, players, agents, and advisors approach, you know, advertising deals and endorsement deals going forward.
Yeah. And one other thing that I think is interesting about this, and that is, I mean, I'm not an agent. I don't represent any player in, with respect to their negotiations with the teams. I've represented a lot of players in civil litigation when they are essentially either the targets of some plaintiff or that they've gotten into a bad deal. In the old days when Brooks Robinson made $100,000, that wasn't there. Even then, it wasn't that much money. But nowadays, when we have athletes with $400 million deals, and the athletes now are essentially multi-gazillionaires, they are going to be the targets of litigation because they are the deep pockets. An individual, a single individual, becomes the deep pocket. And so athletes in this era need to be particularly careful about any kind of representation that they make, because there's always somebody out there who's going to try to take advantage of the fact that they've got so much money.
Ironic, an industry that had billions of dollars of assets evaporate overnight. And now when the dust settles, the brand ambassadors, the athletes are the deep pockets, and the billionaires that foisted this scheme and were the ringleaders of the Ponzi scheme are broke. Assets have evaporated, and the athletes of all people are the ones left holding the bag. Just very ironic. Well, Alan, thank you for joining us today on Conduct Detrimental to sort of discuss your perspective and bring your insights to this really unusual and shocking situation involving the implosion pretty much of an entire industry and how it crosses over into the world that you and I occupy, which is the sports industry. So we'll have you back on when we get closer into the case with class certification, and we'll see where this one goes. But thank you very much for joining us today, and it's always a pleasure to speak to you both on the podcast and off the podcast. I really appreciate it, my friend.
It was my pleasure.
So that was Alan Milstein. He's the chair of the litigation department at the law firm of Sherman and Silverstein. Dan, that was an excellent conversation and probably one that people aren't really finding elsewhere in their sports law space. And obviously we are at the cutting edge of it. Dan, any parting thoughts before we put this episode in the books?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't dive into the nuances of Florida law with Alan, but I have some reservations about the strength of this lawsuit. I think there are two major weaknesses on the liability side. I believe that under the Howey test and under Florida law, that these YBAs appear to be securities. That's the easy analysis. But Florida statutes also requires, in order to hold, I guess, somebody liable for promoting or selling or aiding in the sale of an unregistered security, you need to have personal involvement in inducing the sale. I think an ad read or just a blank advertisement without involvement with the buyer, without personal involvement, active and direct involvement in inducing the sale, anything short of that is really going to be a tough road to hoe in getting this and getting a claim like that past a motion to dismiss. Based upon the case law that I've researched, these celebrity endorsers don't have the kind of active and direct and personal involvement in inducing the sale that would make them liable under the Florida Securities Investor Protection Act. That's Section 517.211 of the Florida statute. So I think it's a weak securities law claim because the absence of some kind of privity slash personal involvement. And on the FDUPTA side, these unfair and deceptive trade practices, putting aside the question of whether there was any attempt to mislead or any likelihood of deception, I think there's going to be a real causation issue, because one of the elements of a deceptive and unfair trade practices claim under Florida law is causation, meaning that the customer, were the misstatements, were the advertisements the cause of the customer buying the securities? And how can you link something that Big Poppy said on a one-off commercial in 2021 or an advertisement and sort of make these athletes the guarantor of billions of dollars of losses without demonstrating actual causation. So there's that issue. And I really, really have some reservations about whether these advertisements and these promotions were likely to deceive, because in most of them, if you go up and down the line and just evaluate all 12 athletes, aside from Kevin O'Leary, most of the athletes are just saying, hey, I'm in. Are you in? I don't think that's the type of statement that is likely to deceive consumers. So if you have, putting aside whether it's certifiable as a class action, I think on the liability issue, there are some real problems.
Okay. Well, Dan, we'll obviously keep tabs on this. It is very, you know, very still much a lawsuit in its infancy, but fantastic job breaking it down with Alan. And yeah, I think that'll do it. It's probably our last episode before Thanksgiving. So all good things. Dan, tremendous job. And I think we can end it here. For all of us here at Conduct Detrimental, we thank you for listening. Please be sure to leave us a 5-star review. Tell your friends about our podcast. It certainly helps grow the platform. And we'll see you next time on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.